Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. As a true crime fan, you probably know that Texas has had its share of women on death row and executed quite a few. One of these women seemed an unlikely killer, as the mother of four. The horrific crime she committed shocked the state of Texas and left quite a few people divided on her sentence. Okay, on to the show. Kimberly Diane Pitts Cargill was born on November 30th, 1966, in Jones County, Mississippi. There are two county seats in Jones County, Laurel and Ellisville. As a side note, Jones County is the site of the historic Free State of Jones, where the county reportedly seceded from the state. Cargill was 12 years old when her mother, Rachel Wilson, and stepfather transplanted from Mississippi to Texas. They settled in the Dallas-Fort Worth suburb of Richardson. It's a fairly affluent suburb. Kimberly had one sister, April, but the two were not very close growing up. Kimberly was friendly and outgoing, described as gregarious by one of her ex-husbands. She was a cheerleader in high school, and although she was a good student, she decided to forego college after high school, and instead was married and had a child. Kimberly was not the easiest person to be married to, and therefore, by her mid-20s, she was single and raising her son on her own. At this time, she was working as a receptionist for a medical equipment company and going through a bitter custody battle. She lost the custody battle, and although she received visitation rights, she was devastated. When a friend wanted to introduce her to Brian Cargill, Kimberly was more than happy to meet him, and so they went on a double blind date. The two hit it off, and within a year, they were married and expecting a child. She got pregnant after about 3 months of dating, leaving her ex-husband Brian to state, quote, "Those were the circumstances under which we got married." The couple had a son, but Kimberly again became impossible to live with, although this time, the marriage lasted 3 years before divorce. Not long after the divorce was final, Kimberly met another man, moved in with him, and had another son. They never married and broke up not long after the baby was born. By 2000, Kimberly was single again and now had two small children to raise on her own. She moved to the Tyler area so she could attend Tyler Junior College and become a licensed vocational nurse, which is one grade below a registered nurse. Through this, however, Brian had continued to try to get supervised visits with their son, and by 2006, he had been granted custody of their son. Her son frequently did not want to talk to her after he moved in with his dad, but in typical Kimberly fashion, she moved on by meeting another man and marrying for the third time. Within a year of their marriage, she gave birth to a fourth son, and within a year of his birth, the couple were divorced. All of Cargill's ex-husbands would later testify that she had a hair-trigger temper, even throwing knives and pans at one husband, and allegedly setting another husband's apartment on fire. Cargill's mother claimed that Kimberly had a good life growing up, that she had a lot of possessions and privileges. She said that she felt like she had been a good mother to her. When Cargill's third son was born in 1999, Wilson flew them up to Portland so they could bond with the baby. Kimberly stayed with her mother for 2 months, but then the relationship began deteriorating, so she took her infant and left, but not before telling her mother, quote, "I hope your cancer comes back and you die a lonely old woman by yourself." Wilson said that she spoke briefly to Cargill at a family function in 2001, but then they were estranged until 2007. In court testimony, Wilson stated that Cargill tells people that she has lupus and Crohn's disease. She even told her adoptive father that. She said that Kimberly was sometimes manipulative and, like everyone else, wanted things to go her way. When she was attending college, she refused to show her parents her grades, so they stopped paying her tuition and she dropped out. Kimberly never seemed to be happy at holidays or birthdays, even when she received the gifts she asked for. And usually, at any family function Kimberly attended, it went awry. Kimberly did not actually have a lot of friends, even though she had been popular and outgoing in high school. Once her mother received custody of Kimberly's son, Kimberly stated she wanted to kill her mother, and this frightened Wilson. Kimberly's sister, April, claimed that they were always estranged and that if it were not for Kimberly's children, she would have nothing to do with her. April once drove by Kimberly's apartment complex on a whim and saw one of her children, then 3 years old, in the courtyard, unattended. So April stopped and walked with the child back to the apartment. She knocked, but no one answered. So she took her nephew back to the courtyard and played with him for another 15 minutes until Kimberly showed up, claiming to have been in the bathroom. Kimberly had supervised visits with one of the children not living with her, so she asked her friend Bill, a White House City employee, to attend the training and be her accountable party. Bill did handyman stuff for her, including mowing her yard, so he agreed to go through the CPS background in order to supervise visits for her. One day, he was in the car with her, en route to a supervised visit with his child, when he told her that he could not stay all day. Kimberly, to put it mildly, became angry and flipped out. She started slapping herself back and forth in the face. Bill, understandably, was taken aback and had no idea of what was going on. He said if he could have, he would have gotten out of the car. He had never seen her act this way before. Kimberly had run-ins with people outside her family and friend circle as well. Teachers for one of her sons had noticed her seemingly erratic mood shifts as well as bruises on their student. Additionally, the boy flinched at any kind of physical contact. The first night two of these teachers met Kimberly was during a meet the teacher or open house night for school. Kimberly became visibly agitated when she realized there was more than one teacher to meet. Later that night, she was crying when she met one of the teachers because another parent had cut in front of her, and she had been waiting in line for a while. At one time, Kimberly had assaulted a senior citizen, Barbara Chamberlain. Kimberly was dating Barbara's step-grandson, Matt. Kimberly had apparently thrown some photos in the front yard, and Barbara had picked these up because they were wet, but Kimberly became enraged. She twisted Beverly's arm and Beverly kicked her. Kimberly was shocked and said, "What's the matter with you? Don't you know I'm pregnant?" Barbara replied, "You may not be anymore." Kimberly had to pay a fine. The charge was reduced to a Class C misdemeanor, and she did not have to go to court. Her first husband, Michael West, maintains that she drove their car into the wall of the garage on purpose one time, and says that their marriage was one of survival. Michael and Kimberly had one child together, who was 21 years old in 2010. Kimberly had supervised visits with him when he was a child until he was about 12 years old, when he requested that the visitation stop altogether. Michael had a photograph of their son with a red mark on his neck, caused by Kimberly choking him. Michael's son David says he didn't consider Kimberly his mother, and only had a few good memories of her. Even as an adult, he lived in fear of her because of the pain she inflicted on him, his half-brothers, and others around them. David was in therapy from the age of 4 until 14 because of the abuse she inflicted. When he was 12, he told Kimberly that when he wanted to see her again, he would let her know. Sonia West was another of Kimberly's victims of abuse. Sonia is Michael's second wife and who David West considers to be his mother. Sonia's daughter, Leanne, was also caught up in one of Kimberly's violent outbursts. One day, as Kimberly was picking up David and Leanne from their house, she was in a hurry, but Leanne was being a child and not moving fast enough to suit Kimberly, so Kimberly picked Leanne up by the arm, hard enough to lift her off the ground. Leanne was crying and in pain, thinking her arm was going to come out of its socket. Sonia took a duffel bag and hit Kimberly, trying to get her off Sonia and Leanne. Kimberly then turned her rage on Sonia and hit her arm on a brick wall. She then grabbed David, threw him in the car, and sped off. This incident occurred on August 1, 1997. On the same day, Kimberly made the statement in front of a Rockwall police officer that if she ever found Sonia West in a dark alley, she would twist her head off. The officer thought this was funny because just a little over a week before, one of his colleagues had received an anonymous phone call where a caller was making the same, rather unusual, threat. Kimberly's children never felt safe with her. Her third son said there was never a time when he felt safe at home with his mom, and he often had to protect his baby brother from her. He had witnessed his mother choking his brother several times, and he also had been a victim of her shoving her fingers down his throat. He said she got mad at him at least 3 times a week. Kimberly was irrational the majority of the time. She got mad at one of her exes because she wanted him to go to his sister's house and start a fight, and he didn't want to. So, in response, she pushed one of her sons out of a moving car. She got mad at another ex one night because he went to a Brahms and got her a sundae, but it had a cherry on it, which she didn't want. So, she threw the sundae at him and then began lashing at him physically, punching him in the face. She put him into a headlock. She threatened him that she would go to the police and claim that he molested their son. Kimberly was also known not to let her children get haircuts because they often had bruises on their foreheads. Another of Kimberly's sons said that she had swapped the locks in one of the rooms so that she could lock her sons in there. He stated that at times, he could be locked in there for as long as 4 hours. Another son had been locked outside wearing gym shorts in 40-degree weather. Kimberly's third husband, Forrest Garner, said Kimberly seemed like she was bipolar, that she could flip a switch and be a different person. She once punched his 5-year-old child in the face and then contacted his ex-wife to tell her that he was abusing drugs. The ex-wife ended up taking back their child, and Kimberly held this over her ex's head, stating that she would sign an affidavit that she had lied if he would not press charges against her for hitting his child in the face. Because of Kimberly, the ex-husband had been in and out of jail for various charges, which caused his parents to go broke trying to assist him. Kimberly even allegedly tried to burn their apartment down before they got married, and he still married her. Garner lived in the same complex as Cherry Walker, and when questioned on the stand about the busyness of the complex on a Friday night, he stated that he was usually annoyed at the number of people around, and this is very important later on. It was this somewhat secret history of violence that Kim was hiding as she started off 2010 working for a fairly prominent chain of hospitals in eastern Texas. She had what appeared to be a nice home. She had custody of her 11-year-old and her 4-year-old sons, and she seemed to enjoy her career. However, babysitter Marcy Fulton had to stop keeping Kim's 4-year-old son, so Marcy introduced Kimberly to Cherry Walker, who lived in the same apartment complex as Marcy. Cherry Walker was born on October 24, 1970, in Tyler, Texas. She was the daughter of Guthrie Walker, who was the pastor of Greater Love Temple Church. Cherry was a kind and loving person, who unfortunately was developmentally disabled. She had the mentality of a 9-year-old, but was learning to live on her own. She was working towards getting a driver's license and had a job at Goodwill through a program for people with disabilities. Cherry had attended elementary school at Orr Elementary and was placed in special education classes in the 2nd grade. She graduated from John Tyler High School through the special education program and in 1995 was seen by a psychologist, Richard Wilson, to determine if she met the legal requirement of, quote, mentally retarded services. Now, it was a crueler and harsher world in the 90s, and that's a direct quote, so I apologize if that offends anyone. Richard Wilson declared that she did qualify for services and found that she had an IQ of 56. He saw her once more in 2000, after she bore a child, and someone thought she was functioning at a higher level than before, but she still met the same requirements. Cherry had to take several pills a night, including a sleep aid, a vitamin, and anti-seizure medications. Cherry was enrolled in a program called Community Access, which provided her with a caseworker to assist with her day-to-day needs as well as teaching her to live on her own. Her caseworker in 2010 was Paula Wheeler, who loved Cherry as if she were her own child. Paula said that Cherry was childlike and sweet and loved money, but she had no real concept of it. Cherry received food stamps and often wanted things she could not afford and thought she was rich if she had 5 $1 bills in her hand. Cherry could not read and her writing was illegible, but she had a heart of gold and loved children. Additionally, Cherry was a very neat and clean person, and it bothered her that her friend Marcy was messy. I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor. Paulus and the Cherry did not know how to react if someone became angry at her, and she would become even more childlike and start shaking and get visibly upset. Paula urged Cherry to not watch Kimberly's son, but Cherry liked the extra money and loved the little boy. In March of 2010, the father of Kimberly's 11-year-old son filed custody paperwork. He stated that this time he had proof that she had been physically abusive. He had photographs documenting the bruises and bite marks that she had inflicted on their son. In May of that year, the 4-year-old was removed from the home and placed in the care of Kimberly's mother, Rachel Wilson. A hearing was scheduled to take place in June of 2010. On June 18, 2010, at 10:18 a.m., while Paula Wheeler was at Cherry Walker's house, Cherry was served with a subpoena to testify in the custody hearing for Kimberly's 4-year-old son, Luke. Cherry was confused and then became very upset as Paula explained to her what a subpoena was. Cherry called Kimberly 2 minutes after the subpoena was served and left her a voicemail. Kimberly checked the voicemail at 10:48 and a minute later called Cherry back, talking to her for almost 9 minutes. Now, bear in mind that Kimberly was on duty as an LVN on this day, and according to her supervisor, Patricia McNally, nurses were not supposed to be on their phone during their shift. But barely a minute after hanging up from Cherry, Kimberly called her back, then called her attorney at 11:06 a.m. At 11:07 a.m., Kimberly called Laura Gillespie, an ETMC clinical manager in White House. Kimberly kept Laura on the phone for about 12 minutes and at times was screaming so loudly that Laura could not be heard. Kimberly testified on the stand that she was concerned for the safety of the workers in the clinic. Kimberly again called Cherry several more times while on duty at ETMC and in total made 70 calls that day to various people, including Marcy Fulton, who had also been subpoenaed to testify. Kimberly told Marcy that she did not have to testify and that she could either leave town or hide out at her house. She told Cherry the same thing. Kimberly called two friends as well, Angela Hardin and Bill Selman. Both of them said she sounded frantic and worried, and she told Angela that if Cherry testified, it would, quote, ruin everything. She told Bill that she was afraid she would lose custody of Luke if Cherry testified. Kimberly later got called into her supervisor's office because patients were complaining that they were not getting their medication. She became instantly defensive, stating that she was taking good care of her patients. However, the break room log showed that she checked in and out of the break room every 10 minutes between 10:45 a.m. and 1 o'clock p.m. Meanwhile, Cherry had a hair appointment that day, something she usually looked forward to. Paula told Cherry that they were first going to drive to the community access office to talk to her boss, Pertina Young. Then they could go to the hair appointment. When they arrived, Pertina made a copy of the subpoena for Cherry's file and contacted the district attorney's office to explain that Cherry was mentally challenged. Paula then took Cherry to her hair appointment, but Cherry was shaken and didn't want to go. Paula finally had to make Cherry get out of the car, which came back to haunt her later. Cherry went back to her apartment after the appointment and contacted Paula again, still worried about the subpoena, and she also called Marcy Fulton. Marcy and Cherry agreed they were not going to lie for Kimberly. Kimberly called Cherry and said she wanted to take her out for a nice dinner, and also offered to pay Cherry to clean her house. Cherry called Paula Wheeler, who urged Cherry not to go, telling her to take her medicine, lock the door, and go to bed. Kimberly clocked out of ETMC at 7:30 p.m., and while on her way to Cherry's apartment, was stopped for speeding by a Chandler police officer, Arthur McKenzie. He noted that she was a nurse and asked her if she had an emergency. At 8:01 p.m., Cherry called Kimberly and told her not to come over. At 8:02 p.m., Kimberly called Cherry. Between 8:02 p.m. and 12:23 a.m., Kimberly made no other phone calls or texts. Hours after she left ETMC, she received calls from them because she had left 7 charts uncharted. They finally reached her at 12:23 a.m. Phone records show that after June 19th, Kimberly never called Cherry again. On June 19, 2012, at 7:25 a.m., Kimberly's neighbor Lauren ran into her outside. Thinking that this was fairly early for Kimberly, she made the usual neighborly small chit-chat. She said, "What are you doing up so early?" Kimberly said that she was just going to clean out her car. Now, according to Kimberly's friend Bill, Kimberly's car was notoriously nasty inside and out. She had food wrappers all over the car. Bill said that she did not have the time to clean it, but when he ran into her at Burger King later that day, her car was spotless, inside and out. A few hours after she saw her neighbor, Kimberly walked into the White House Police Department under the pretense of asking about her dog that had been missing for 2 months. During the course of the conversation, she asked the officer if it had, quote, been a slow day. Around 3:18 p.m. on June 19th, Bobby Lewis, a Pizza Hut delivery driver, made a wrong turn on a rural road. He pulled into a grassy area to turn around and saw something odd. Bobby stopped the car and, as he approached the object, realized that it was a burned body. He only got within 10 to 15 feet of the object before verifying it. He returned to his car, called 911, and remained until police arrived. He stayed at the scene for about 2.5 hours. He said the area was overgrown and that there was ash all around the body. Photographs of the crime scene and the bottom of the victim's shoes show that her shoes were still white, indicating that she had just been dumped there. The location was about 8 to 10 miles from Cherry Walker's apartment. There was no identification on the body, and the police had no idea who it was. The next day, the news ran an item about it, and Cherry Walker's father, Guthrie, realized it might be his daughter, who had not been at church that morning, which was very unusual. He contacted the police and told them, quote, "I think that's my daughter." They were able to obtain dental records and confirmed her identity. The body belonged to Cherry. The first suspect was Cherry's friend/boyfriend, Joseph Mayo. He met Cherry at Goodwill, where they both worked. He had also tried out for American Idol, and the police brought him in for questioning and told him to come clean, but he had an alibi, and there was video footage. He was singing karaoke at a local bar. Joey said that Cherry always believed in him, and they loved watching scary movies together. This brought the investigators back to square one, until they received a phone call from Paula Wheeler, who said she knew exactly who killed Cherry Walker. Police were taken aback by her confidence, but she explained all she knew about Kimberly Cargill and the events that took place after the subpoena was served. This put Kimberly on the detective's radar. They obtained a search warrant for her car and her house. The car, as previously mentioned, was spotless. The house, although not yielding any evidence relevant to the case, did show investigators how disgusting Kimberly was and substantiated reports that her car usually looked the same way. They stated that apparently the bathtub was being used as a trash can and the master bedroom was strewn with trash, including fast food bags, creamer wrappers, and other types of trash. On June 24th, 2 days after her car was searched, Kimberly was arrested on charges of injury to a child. These charges stemmed from the abuse allegations her ex-husband had made about their 11-year-old son. While she was in custody for this, investigators obtained a DNA sample. They wanted to compare the DNA they had found at the crime scene on a creamer wrapper from Burger King. Additionally, one of Kimberly's friends came forward and stated that she had received a call from Kimberly after Cherry's body had been found. Kimberly was distressed and stated that her babysitter had been found burning in a field, which was puzzling, because at this time, Cherry's name had not been released. Confirming Kimberly's identity was the DNA. It proved to be a match. On July 29th, police arrested Kimberly for the murder of Cherry Walker. She would not go to trial until May 7th, 2012. During the trial, evidence was presented as to Cherry Walker's epilepsy, since this was the foundation of the defense's case. Dr. Meredith Land, the medical examiner who had conducted the autopsy on Cherry on June 20th, maintained that the cause of death was homicidal, although the means were unknown. She found evidence consistent with asphyxiation. There were abrasions on her forehead and cheeks consistent with being dragged over gravel, but it appeared that she was on a sheet or something else while being dragged. There was no evidence of soot or ash in her lungs, indicating that she was no longer breathing when she was burned. Cherry had no defensive wounds, but had numerous bruises to indicate that someone purposely assaulted her and caused bodily injury. In particular, there were bruises to the left side of Cherry's face and head. Lan reviewed Cherry's medical records and found that she had unspecified epilepsy. Cherry had said twice in 2010 that she had seizures, but when questioned by her doctor, she denied any symptoms associated. Dr. Land said that when she died, the level of her anti-seizure medication was still in the low to therapeutic range, so she didn't feel as if Cherry had a seizure which killed her. Dr. Land was somewhat incredulous that Kimberly, a nurse, would not know what to do if a passenger in her car had a fatal seizure. Dr. Richard Ulrich, a neurologist, also testified that he had treated Cherry for epilepsy from 2003 to 2009. He stated that it was possible to die from a seizure, but it was fairly uncommon, less than a 10% chance for someone with epilepsy, and that was if there were underlying issues. Dr. Ulrich maintained that he did not believe that Cherry had died of sudden unexpected death in epilepsy syndrome. Kimberly Cargill took the stand in her own defense, sobbing and gasping throughout the entire testimony. Her attorney gently asked her questions as to what happened on the night of Cherry Walker's death. Kimberly said that she had arrived at Cherry's apartment around 8:25 to take her to dinner. She said that Cherry was ironing her clothes, so she waited in the car for her. Cherry came out about 8:30 and they left. On the way to eat, Kimberly said she remembered that she had to meet a friend at her house, and this friend was allegedly Bill Selman. She went to her house and found that Bill was not there, so she told Cherry just to wait in the car so she could charge her phone and use the bathroom. Kimberly said they ate at a Posado's restaurant, which is a Mexican food restaurant, and were there for about an hour having a pleasant conversation. When they left, she said that Cherry wanted her to drop her off somewhere. But Kimberly did not feel comfortable about it, so she started heading back towards Cherry's apartment. Cherry became upset and began shaking and hitting her head on the window. Now remember, Dr. Land pointed out bruises on the left side of Cherry's face and head, not the right side, which you would expect if she were striking her head so violently against the window. Kimberly opened the car door and Cherry fell to the ground. Within seconds, her seizure had stopped. Kimberly said she looked all around the complex for help, but could not find anyone. This was completely opposite of the testimony her ex had to say about a Friday night in the apartment complex. He said that it was usually teeming with people. When Kimberly came back, she said that Cherry was in the same position and did not have a pulse. So she began doing CPR on her, but then realized that it was not doing any good, so she put Cherry back in the car and was driving her to the hospital. She realized at this point that Cherry had been non-responsive for 10 minutes, so she could not bring herself to go into the hospital. She drove around for 30 minutes in a panic, not knowing what to do, until she turned down a country road and stopped the car. She pulled Cherry out of the car, thinking all the while about how her DNA was all over Cherry. So she took out some lighter fluid, you know, like we all carry in our cars, and set Cherry on fire to destroy the DNA evidence that she had left behind while performing CPR. She told her attorney she was only thinking of herself that night. The prosecutor, Matt Bingham, asked Kimberly why she had never told this story before now. Previously, she had told multiple stories about her dinner with Cherry, or her non-dinner with Cherry. She even said that Cherry went to eat with some white man instead of her. He also asked Kimberly why she was making crying noises in court. Kimberly replied that she was trying not to cry. He fired back, wanting to know why she wasn't crying on the White House Police Department video, even though she knew Cherry's body was lying face down in the dirt, 50 feet from a trash pile. He says to her, quote, "On the very same day Cherry gets subpoenaed and she's never seen again, you take her to a dump site and spray lighter fluid all over her back. Kimberly's answer? I didn't know it was a dump site. Bingham claimed that Kimberly pulled Cherry into the garage and killed her there, but Kimberly flatly denied it. It has been speculated, however, that one reason she pulled up was to get a bedsheet or bedspread to drag Cherry's body with. Bingham asked why Kimberly didn't turn around or yell for help. Kimberly continued to say that she could not make a U-turn because the traffic was heavy. She asked, quote, "You mean keep everyone blocked behind me?" Bingham very sarcastically replied, quote, "Yeah, I'd hate to block everyone in while a person is having a seizure." Bingham asked Kimberly how it felt to pull Cherry's sweet body out of her car and then spray her with lighter fluid before setting her on fire. He then showed the jury photos of injuries inflicted by Kimberly onto her sons. For each injury, Kimberly had an excuse, which he called her on. Kimberly went to Burger King on Saturday, the night she had dumped and burned Cherry's body, which is where that creamer wrapper came from. One witness attempted to help Kimberly's case, and that was forensic psychologist Dr. Antoinette McGarren. She testified that Kimberly had a borderline personality disorder, and that in the months leading to the episode, she had been taking several medications that could have exacerbated some of the symptoms you'd see ordinarily. Kimberly had been taking prednisone, Celexa, and Klonopin. Dr. McGarren said that to stop taking Celexa and Klonopin suddenly could have serious side effects, such as serious rebound effects. Dr. McGarren also alleged that Kimberly had been sexually assaulted and abused when she was just 11 years old, but I can't substantiate this in any way. After all the evidence, all the history of abuse, Kimberly Cargill was found guilty of the murder of Cherry Walker. In the sentencing phase of the trial, she was sentenced to death row. On April 26, 2017, Texas' highest criminal court refused an appeal from Kimberly Cargill. As of today, Kimberly is awaiting her execution at the Mountain View Unit in Gatesville, Texas. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Special thanks to Suzanne St. John, who researched and wrote this episode. It was a nice treat, so thank you, Suzanne.